Dad, who do you think's more excited to see me come home this weekend, you or Mom?
I would think probably Katie and Sarah, your daughters.
Those are my sisters. Those are your daughters.
Yeah.
Hold on to your butts. It's the Mast Cast.
On this week's episode of the Mast Cast, former Cup Series driver Rick Mast and his non-driving son Ricky recap the race from Bristol, and they discuss whether or not the old Bristol is back. Rick also discusses the art of bumping and running, and he recalls some old stories, including his infamous battle with Jack Ingram at Milwaukee in 1985 in the Xfinity Series, as well as a run-in with his pal Mike Skinner at Richmond. Rick also discusses what he feels like today's drivers need to do to help regain some of NASCAR's popularity, and Rick and Ricky are both very excited for their upcoming live MastCast this weekend at Richmond Raceway. All right, Dad, I kept seeing the old Bristol is back, the quote-unquote, quote fingers in the air, the old Bristol is back. First of all, what is the quote-unquote old Bristol, and was it in fact, quote-unquote, back?
The old Bristol is you got one groove and it's the bottom of the racetrack. You got one groove right at the very bottom. And I guess this race, it stayed at the bottom longer, I guess longer than it had since they been trying to fix it. It used to be you go to Bristol, the fastest way around the racetrack was right on the very bottom, and everybody tried to get to the bottom. And if you protected the bottom, you know you were okay. What would happen? Somebody would get a little run on you coming off turn four or turn two and get their right front up to your left rear just a little bit. And then when you'd enter either three or one, that's when the problems would start. The guy that was in front, a lot of times he wouldn't give the guy behind him any room and he just cut down. And normally for the first part of the race, the guy would back down if he was behind. And as the race would go on and the guys would get tired and their attention spans were not as good. They were not thinking probably as good as they should have. And they're more of a I don't give a shit mood to later get in the race. And when that happens, the guy behind wouldn't get out of the gas and then they would hit and they would wreck. And it happened numerous times. So this particular race here, that's why they kept putting that sticky stuff, whatever they call it, the sticky stuff on the bottom. That's what that was all about, trying to make the bottom groove the fastest groove and the preferred groove all day. You kept hearing drivers during the two-day delay talk about when the upper groove comes in, when the upper groove comes in. Well, it never really did happen, and I don't know if that was a product of being so cold or they ran part of the race Sunday. So they got some laps down. They put more of that sticky on before the race ended on Monday. So I guess all that contributed to staying like that. And lo and behold, it was a damn good race all day.
All right. Now tell me something. Granted, I haven't always paid that close of attention, so you can tell me if I'm wrong, but that sticky stuff, is that something they've done before elsewhere that you remember seeing? I mean, I popped on the TV the other day and saw that, and I couldn't, and again, maybe they have used it in recent years. It didn't register in my memory.
No, as far as I know, when they started using it at Bristol a couple of years ago, very first time I ever heard it used on an oval track. I think it started from the drag racing deal. They use a product similar to that on drag strips, you know, in the launching pads, right, where they take off. Now don't quote me on that or take that to the bank, but I think that's where the stuff got its beginnings at, and they just took it to Bristol to see what it would do. It was kind of surprising the first time they used that stuff to me, because I'm like, man, what are we doing here? But, you know, as they've worked with it a little bit, they've kind of made it a little bit better.
Is short track racing in general, do you think it's a better chance or opportunity for drivers to show? Well, let me rephrase that. Is this where drivers have more of an opportunity to shine? Like, is it more driver than car at Bristol as opposed to like a mile and a half?
Well, it is. I mean, the relationship between how much is car, the percentage, how much is car and how much is driver, that's changed a lot over the years. But when you go to short track, you take a couple things out. Number one, you take a lot of the aerodynamics out. Yeah, aerodynamics still come into play, but not like a place like Charlotte or Texas. You know, it's down, but it still shows up. the mechanical grip, you have to rely more on mechanical grip than aero grip on a short track. And when you do that, then that puts it back in the crew chief's hands and the engineer's hands and the driver's hands to figure out what the car is doing and what he can do spring-wise, shock-wise. You know, all that stuff starts figuring back into it a little bit. So it does put it back into the hands of the guys actually at the racetrack that weekend, that day, working on the car, trying to make changes to make it better. And then it parlays into Sunday for the race. The driver, you know, having to do what he's got to do to try to make the thing work. So, yeah, it does put it – there's no doubt about it. Short tracks puts it back more in the driver's hands.
Yeah, I guess the main thing that made me think of that as I was watching, you know, regardless of, you know, Hendrick is kind of in a, if you want to call it a – well, I'll put it in baseball terms, a rebuilding year phase. But you see Jimmy Johnson up there mixing it up, and then you see a maybe underfunded – team like the 43 and Bubba Wallace up there mixing it up, and then of course Kyle Busch winning. I mean, he's love him or hate him, he's I think as naturally gifted as any driver out there today, not just in NASCAR. So I that's just kind of what made me think is short tracks, it just seems like it's a little bit more of an opportunity for a driver to do more. Yeah,
and
you know,
and add Stenhouse to that list also.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. I'm sorry, I'm and honestly I meant to put him on that list too. Yeah, he ran great as well.
So really, if you talk about the biggest thing, you go from aero grip to mechanical grip, from a big track to little track, and you get to little track and you see Stenhouse running good, Wallace running good, you see Johnson up there running good, then it kind of tells you maybe these guys have got a little bit of an aero problem, because we're talking about the Chevrolets. Well, there's Stenhouse, but we're talking a lot about the Chevrolets, you know, not doing as good as everybody thought, and they're still working with this new nose and all that. So, you know, I don't know. The other part of it is short track racing is just exciting. You know, I don't care if you go to Richmond, Bristol, Martinsville. It's just, it puts on an exciting event, you know, and everybody gets excited about it. And I know when I was racing, you know, you just felt like as a driver, you had more control over how you were going to run that weekend when you'd go to a Richmond, as opposed to going to a Texas, because you're so dependent on aero and the car at these big tracks, and you just felt good about things going into a short track, because you're like, man, I can make a difference this weekend.
All right, now the bump and run at Bristol, is there, and that's something, especially with the old Bristol, and apparently it being back at least for this week, is there a like the strategy with bump and run? I mean, is there a specific way that you're always meaning to do that with, where you move the guy without wrecking him? I mean, how much of that is strategy, and how much of that is just you're hoping that you don't wreck them, but you move them. I mean, is there specific art to it?
Yeah, it is. It's a very specific art to it, and it's all about doing it without wrecking the guy and wrecking yourself, and the point on the racetrack in which you do it. A good case in point of a bad bump and run, and a way you do not do a bump and run, is the way Hamlin did Elliott last year at Martinsville. Okay, he that was a bump and run, but it was a wreck and go, you know, that was a bad deal. If everybody can remember that, going in turn three, he just flat railed. He just nailed him, and just, it was a bad deal. A bump and run is exactly what you saw Busch do to Larson Monday. We saw it with Gordon. We saw it with Jarrett. We saw it with Earnhardt and Labonte, all those guys. We saw it many times. You see it at Loudon. I saw it at Loudon between Gordon and Jarrett, Bristol. Every time we raced there, somebody was getting the bump and run. And really what you're doing is you're tapping the car. You're just getting the car light in the rear. The guy you're running up against, you're going to get him light in the rear, right in the center of the corner, right in the apex where you want to do it, or right before the apex. When it's the slowest speed you're going to run is right in that apex, but it's also when the car is loaded the most. So all you got to do really is just lightly tap the dude. And when you do that, it just lifts the wheels up a little bit. He loses traction, and the car gets loose, and he has to chase the car up the racetrack. You just turn your nose under him and go on. It doesn't take much. It doesn't take much of a bump at all. Really, if you do it going into the turn, you're probably going to wreck him because the car is not loaded as hard. If you do it exiting the turn, you're probably going to wreck the guy. But you got to do it right at the apex or right before the apex. That's where the perfect bump and run is done. And then once you do that, you got to realize how many laps you got left till the checkered flag falls. And if I do bump and run this guy, how many laps do we got till the checkered? And when I do bump and run and get by him, will he be able to retaliate? I mean, is my car fast enough to get away from him? You know, to risk doing this. If you're running the guy, you're running one and two, and your cards are about equal, and he bobbles a little bit, and you're able to bump him and move him, and you still got 10 laps to go, more than likely you're not going to do it if you know your car is equal to him, because there's 9 laps left, then he's going to probably do it back to you. But if he's holding you up big time, and you know if you get by him, you go on, you'll do it and go on. And it also depends on if it comes down to the last lap or 2 laps to go. All these things figure into when is the optimum time to do that. Now, keep in mind, once you do that and the race is over, you got to expect that it's going to happen to you at the next race or the next opportunity that comes up, that it's going to happen back to you. So, you know, it's you know, you could do it to win, but you got to expect it's going to happen back to you. It's just the way it is.
Is Bristol let's stick with the 3 short tracks, although I kind of like the fact you brought up Loudon and some other places, but with the 3 short tracks, I mean, is Bristol the most prominent place for it, or is it just kind of equal, or I mean, is...
No, it is, and it is because of that lower groove deal. What happens at Bristol, a very slight touch will move. If you hit the guy right when the car is loaded the most, right in the apex, right in the center of the turn, if you do it to him right there, with us, say you hit him, if we could measure this somehow, Ricky, but if you hit him with, say, 50 pounds of force with your bumper, you hit the guy and it gets just enough to get him out of shape to get by him. You go to Richmond, that 50 pounds of force is not going to move that guy as much, because your car is not loaded up in the center of the turn as with as much force on it. You can hit him with that 50 pounds of force, you might get him squirrely, but you're not going to move him. You might take double that. It might take 100 pounds of hitting force to actually move the car. So that's why at Bristol, it's so prominent at Bristol, you see it so much, because all it takes is a very, very, very light tap at Bristol to do that. And because the car is loaded so heavily, that's what upsets the car so much there.
Is there any, you mentioned Loudon, is there any of the bigger tracks, non-short tracks, I should say, where it's a little bit more prominent? I never thought about that with Loudon. Is it Loudon or any other places?
Well, Loudon feels and drives like a short track. Okay, it's just even though it's a mile track, it's flat, and you set the car up chassis wise, and you drive it as driver wise as a short track. So you know that comes into play. Dover's the same length, a mile, but it drives like a speedway. You don't do a bump and run at Dover. If you do that, most time you're going to wreck both of you. It's just some tracks. Phoenix, a little bit you can get away with, a little bit at Phoenix, a little bit of bump and run there, but not a whole lot. But
What about turn 3 at Pocono?
Well, the thing about Pocono is you don't see that happening too much. I mean, the guys do it. Who was it? Mayfield, I guess, hit Earnhardt and won the race that year. He did that bump and run to him. You know, you're traveling such a tremendous amount of speed in turn 3 at Pocono. You can wiggle a guy a little bit, but it's just that you've passed at Pocono in turn 3. When you're able to really do a bump to the guy, you're past the what we call the apex of the turn. You're already back in the gas. Your car is already turned. You're already back in the gas and exiting the turn. It's just a long exit off of turn 3 at Pocono. And it just doesn't set itself up very many times to do what we call bump and run. It's just the nature of the track, the way it is, the layout of the turn.
Okay. I got you. Well, it's interesting. I'm asking all this because I've just never really thought about it much beyond short track racing before. So it's, and Pocono to me, I guess the reason I wanted to bring up turn 3 specifically is because turns 1 and 2, I mean, inherently you'd think that they're just going way too fast there. I didn't know if you were still carrying, turn 3 just seems so much slower. I didn't know if there was a little bit more of an opportunity there, which.
You definitely don't want to do it in 1 or the tunnel turn at Pocono, because you take a big chance on wrecking yourself when you do this. It's just the way it's configured, the way the loads are on the car. You take a bigger chance on wrecking yourself. Plus, when you wreck the guy in front of you, you wreck hard there, you know, because it's just the way the track's laid out. You wreck hard. Like in any big track, if you try to wreck somebody, you're going to really try to hurt somebody. Pocono, the only way you get away with it a little bit is, you know, past the apex of turn 3, coming off 3. The unique part about 3 or turn 3 at Pocono is that's a key component about that racetrack, because the longest straightaway on the NASCAR circuit is a front stretch at Pocono. So everything you do getting into 3 and getting back, when you get back in the gas at turn 3 at Pocono, that makes a big difference overall lap speed, because if you come off turn three a little bit quicker, you carry that quicker speed all the way down the front straightaway, which makes your lap time better. That was an old Harry Gantt trick was taught to me. But anyhow, that has nothing to do with bump and runs.
Okay. All right. Quick side, maybe we should save this for Pocono, but I just always love the fact that why Pocono is configured the way it is. Can you name the three tracks that those three turns were modeled after? Do you remember them off the top of your head?
It was Indy.
That's the tunnel turn at Pocono, right? Turn two, right?
Indy, mm-hmm. Phoenix.
Nope.
No, I don't know.
Okay.
I'll go ahead.
All right. Turn one was modeled after Trenton Speedway.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So that's the hard one. Turn two is Indy, the tunnel turn. And then turn three is the Milwaukee Mile.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. Yeah. I love Milwaukee. We raced up there in the Busch Series. Yeah. I love that racetrack. It was a neat racetrack.
Do you know, not too long ago, this was sometime within the last couple of years, MRN does those those flashback races. They'll just throw up an old, or you can go listen to an entire old broadcast of a race. Your race against Jack Ingram in the Busch Series in the Xfinity Series now, in 1985, I guess. There's no tape of that, and I had just seen newspaper clippings from it where you're all fighting for the win on the last lap. But I'd never heard any broadcast or anything of it. And it was sometime within the last couple of years, I saw the MRN tweeted or something like that, that today's flashback race, and I can't think of what I know they have like a theme or a name for it, but that the flashback race was going to be this 85 race from the Milwaukee Mile. And I sat there and listened to the whole race. Man, it was so cool to hear that, this thing that I'd read about in old newspaper articles and everything, to actually hear a broadcast of it was pretty neat. Was Milwaukee a bump and run kind of place?
It was just long, flat, sweeping turns, and it's just a big mile flat race. It really is kind of like Loudon, a lot like Loudon, to be honest with you. Mile, big, flat, wide. You know, it was such a cool race, cool amenities. I remember driving up to that place. We went through, where was that? Someplace in Illinois, Chicago, before you get to Chicago. Man, all these blown out buildings and, you know, everything, everywhere you looked, there's just despair and poverty looking and just bad looking stuff. Man, we get to Milwaukee, absolutely the cleanest city I'd ever seen in my life. They wouldn't let a piece of paper lay on the ground in that place. But anyhow, we went there for that Busch race, and then I think our Busch partners, they took us to a Major League Baseball game while we were there, did a lot of stuff, went to one of the beer breweries while we were there. And then the race itself, man, it was cool. We had some ASA guys there with us. I remember that was the first time I ever witnessed or saw Alan Kowicki. He was there racing. I think it was in Ed Whitaker's car. Ed Whitaker had a car that, for those who don't remember, Ed Whitaker is the guy that owned the 7 car that Harry Gantt used to win all those Busch Grand National races with a SCO sponsorship. But anyhow, I don't know. We looked up. We were leading that race at the end, and it was, I don't know, it was 5 or 6 of us, man. We battled all day long. I remember it was Houston and Jack Ingram. I think Sam was in the middle of the mix. A bunch of us, maybe Morgan. I don't know who all, but anyhow, we look up 3 or 4 laps ago, and I'm leading the race. And I never forget, coming off turn 4 to take the white, I screwed up. He was behind me, and Jack Ingram, he got a little run on me, and he got his nose under me coming off 4, and he carried it down into 1. And we, with 1 lap to go, he got right dead beside me. Well, he kind of ran into me a little bit, and I turned back into him. And we came off turn 2, and he's trying to crowd me a little bit against the wall, and I didn't like that, so I turned left hard into him. And we beat all the way down the back straightaway. We go into turn 3, and I'm expecting Jack to run me up the racetrack to go by me, and he didn't do that. But needless to say, we beat off of then through 3 and 4. Then we beat all the way down the front straightaway, and Jack, I mean, we just kept beating each other. I turned left, he turned right, man, for a whole lap. And he beat me just by a few feet and won the race. And I came in, we got out of the car, and looked, the whole left side of my car was tore up, man. It was tore up. I'm like, good Lord, we beat our cars up. So to be honest with you, it's one of those deals, Ricky, where I wasn't mad at all. I was mad at myself for letting him get under me to start with 1 to go. But it was just one of those deals where I just absolutely loved that race, and especially the last lap, because even though we were beating on each other, he didn't take advantage of me to put me in a bad position, and he could have, and I also could have done the same thing to him, and we didn't. So anyhow, I get out of the car. So I go down to Victory Lane to congratulate Jack. I'm going to congratulate him, right? And I go up, and they got the podium set up, and Jack and all these guys are standing on the podium, and I start walking up the steps. Well, I see all these guys looking at me, and they just kind of turn around from me, right? And I go up to Jack, and Jack has a bad look of expression on his face. And it dawned on me what was going on. All these guys thought I was coming down and start a fight, right? And I just, when I realized what was happening, I just took my hand and took it out and pointed it to him before I even got to him to see, let him know, man, I'm not here to fight you. I'm just here to shake your hand. So I grabbed his hand and shook it, and we talked for a little bit, and I congratulated him, and I went on. And, you know, we came on home, drove home that night. Well, hell, it was a day and a half. Well, we left that race driving, and we got home. I think it was like noon the next day. It's a long ways. But anyhow, I'll never forget Johnny Hayes, the guy that at Skoll that 5 years later or 6 years later hired me to drive for my first Winston Cup deal. He said, Rick, he told me one time, he said, Rick, you know, the first time I really knew about you or anything about you or whatnot was I was listening to the race at Milwaukee in 1985. I said, yeah. And he said, y'all, you and Jack had that great battle. He said, MRN came and interviewed after the race, and we were all expecting a bunch of stuff. And he said, you got on there and you were just as happy as you could be. And you were thanking your crew and thanking the good race Jack did and all that. He said, that stuck with me all these years. And I see, because he said, now there's a young dude right there that we need to keep our eye open for, you know? So you don't know, you just never know, you know, what opportunities might be out there related to how you carry yourself and things that go on, you know?
Oh, that's I can apply that to what I do now and how I ended up in working in Major League Baseball. I mean, I had, if you go back, I believe this would have been, gosh, a little over 5 years ago now, I came down to Atlanta just for a temporary little two-week gig with the Braves in the offseason. Basically, they did this thing where they used to do this thing called the Braves Country Caravan, where they had a bus, and they every day for a couple weeks, they'd get a few players, and you'd go, you know, you'd make like an autograph appearance somewhere, and then you do like an appearance at a kids hospital or veterans hospital, and then maybe do another autograph appearance. And this would go on, we'd go somewhere in the Southeast every day with Alabama, obviously places in Georgia, Alabama, South Carolina. I know we went to Charlotte, I think we went to Nashville. But anyways, this was always just a temporary gig for me. My last day on this little two-week stint with the Braves. Again, it wasn't a long-term job or anything, just a little cool little opportunity they gave me to help out with this thing and do some social media things and some live event stuff. My last day on that Braves Country Caravan, there was a woman who was starting her first day as a what we would call a trainee, or maybe other places would call an intern with the Braves, and she was on the bus, and she was very happy to be there, and she introduced herself to me and said, hi, I'm such and such, and, you know, it's my first day. And I knew this was my last day, and then I was heading back to Virginia. I said, hey, my name's Ricky, but you don't need to remember my name. I'm nobody important, like just kind of joking around or whatever. I had completely forgotten about that. I didn't remember it. Just wasn't a big deal. But anyways, I was nice to her that day. She was nice to me, and we kept up with each other. You fast forward a couple years later, and she contacted me out of the blue about a position she thought maybe I'd be interested in or be good for with the Braves, and here I am now working in Major League Baseball. And it really started with just a chance encounter to where, you know, I was friendly to her and she was nice to me, and then she just, because of that, and that day with her, and like I said, I didn't remember it or anything, but to her, she remembered that. She remembered exactly what I said and how I was and what I did, and just that one day has now led me into the career I have now. What is your saying? It's not hard to be nice to people. Isn't that something you've said before?
Well, yeah, it's easier to smile and be nice than it is to be grumpy and bitching all the time about everything.
Exactly.
To me, it just, I mean, I went through that phase of in racing certain times when things are not going right, man, you can go down that path so easily. And so many of my buddies went down that path, and that, you know, some of them were successful doing it, and that's fine, but it wasn't for me, you know, it wasn't my makeup, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah. All right, back to the real quick. I want to add, because since we talk so much about the bump and run stuff, I just want to see, and maybe there isn't anything that comes to mind, but is there, for you, is there, when you think of bump and run, is there times where you think of where you did it to where it was like, man, that was the best I ever did it, or it was an opportune time to do it and it worked out, and then maybe times where it really backfired on you? Is there any examples that pop to mind when you think about it, or not?
No, really? not right off, Ricky. I did move a guy one time at Bristol. I did it at the wrong spot. I did it past the apex, exit in turn two, And when I did it, it was, I think it's one of those deals towards the end of the race. I'd done about had enough anyhow, dude blocking me. When I did it, it actually wrecked the guy, you know, kind of felt bad that it wrecked him, but you know, it was just the way it was. So you just had to keep on going. So no, never really got into a whole lot of that stuff. I know, who was it I wrecked one time? Skinner. Yeah, should we get into the, this is Richmond coming up. We'll talk about the Skinner wreck.
Yeah, that is quite a story.
Yeah, we were running since Richmond's coming up, and we're going to be down there at Richmond, which we'll talk about in a little bit. But we were running, and Skinner was driving for Childress, and I don't know, halfway, three-quarters of the way through the race, they had a caution. They had a double-file restart, and those are the days when the lap cars started on the inside, lead lap cars on the outside. Well, I believe it was Earnhardt leading. I'm not sure. But anyhow, Skinner was running second. On the inside lane right beside Earnhardt up front was Kenny Schrader. And he was like sixth or seventh one lap down. And I'm right behind Schrader. So I'm sixth, seventh, or eighth one lap down. So anyhow, they drop the green flag. We go through one and two and come off the backstretch. And I'm fighting Schrader for sixth position. I'm fighting Schrader for sixth position. Of course, Skinner, he's trying to do what he can do to win this race. We go into turn three, and I'm down low on the racetrack. Skinner's on the outside, and somehow or another, me and him make contact. Okay? I mean, we just and Skinner did not come out on the good end. Skinner hit the wall and tore up his car, and we went ahead and finished the race. Well, the race is over. At that point, I was pretty good friends with Skinner, or at least I thought I was. Well, the race was over. When it was all said and done, I walked out of the garage area and I walked to the motorhome lot and I saw Skinner's motorhome and I'm thinking, you know what? I probably ought to go talk to Skinner tonight so this stuff don't fester. And because that's just kind of the way I used to do things. So I go up to his motorhome and I peer in the window and Skinner's sitting on his couch and all he's got on is his shorts, right? And Angie, Miss Skinner, which I don't think they had gotten married at the time. She was sitting on top of Skinner, straddling him on the couch, and all she had on was a t-shirt. And, so I'm watching this, you know, and
they were doing some bumping and running too, weren't they?
They were doing a little bumping and grinding, a little bumping and running, you know, really, really getting things going. And so I was sitting there for maybe, I don't know, 10 or 15 seconds watching it in the mirror. I think, man, I'm turning into a pervert here. Well, I don't know what hit me, but I just started laughing, man. Something about it just made me start laughing. And they heard me, and I'll never forget Angie. She turned and looked at the door and saw me, and her expression, man, her mouth flew wide open, her eyes got, and she jumped off of Skinner and ran to the back of the motorhome. And I'm sitting there laughing, and Skinner's looking at me. So here he walks to the door with nothing but his shorts on. He opens up the door. I say, hey, Mike, he says, Mass, let me tell you something. That's the second time you've effed me tonight. I said, Mike, I'm sorry about that. I said, let me tell you something, dude. He said, and he was agitated. There's no doubt. He wanted to be mad at me, but he couldn't, but he was agitated. Anyhow, I told him, I said, Mike, let me tell you something, dude. I says, I will admit to you that we hit, you know, whether it's your fault or my fault, you know, we can sit here and argue all you want to. I said, but we did hit going into turn three. I said, but from that moment forward, you are the one that elected to wreck. I didn't wreck you. I didn't wreck you. You're the one elected to wreck after we hit. He just looked at me. He sat there. It was probably a dead stare for 10 or 15 seconds. And he just lit in this tyrant titany. He lit in this thing of cussing me, right? And I was just sitting there laughing at him and finally quit cussing. I said, I'll see you next week, Skinner, and shut the door. Well, the next week, the funny part of this whole story, next week, McReynolds was his crew chief, Larry. Larry came up to me and said, Rick Bass. I said, yeah, Larry. He says, I was thinking about that deal last week. I said, yeah, man, I'm sorry all that happened. He said, no. He said, listen. He said, I've been racing for, at that time, 25 or 30 years. He said, I've been in all kinds of situations. But when Skinner told me what you told him, I thought to myself, I have never heard anything like that. I said, what are you talking about, McReynolds? He says, you told Skinner, says, yeah, I hit you, but you're the one that elected to wreck. I said, yeah, I did tell him that. And I've heard Larry McReynolds repeat that quote a dozen times over the years. But anyhow, typical short track racing.
Yeah, I know, and that's what we can look forward to this weekend at Richmond. And you brought it up there, and we kind of teased it a little bit here on the last couple episodes of the MassCast, and then we finally officially put it out on Twitter a couple days ago. We are going, not only going to Richmond this weekend to the Toyota 400 there at Richmond International or Richmond Raceway. We're going to be taping MassCast live at Richmond Raceway, 2:00 at the Midway Stage this Saturday at Richmond. We're going to be there. We're going to tape a little bit of the MassCast, and then we're going to be joined by the Racing Virginia podcast, which I'm really looking forward to. I think that's going to be awesome because that's, I mean, I know we talk racing and everything, but even now, I've lived in Georgia almost 3 years, and I just, no matter where I am or where I go from here, I am always a Virginian at heart and still think of myself as a Virginian and always will. So to be able to do our first kind of in front of people, our first recording live podcast in front of folks, and to be doing it with the Racing Virginia guys, I think that's just going to be awesome. I can't thank the good folks at Richmond enough, Dennis, Mark, all the guys there that are having us. That's going to be fun. I can't wait. And then the racing at Richmond is among the best there is anywhere also. So, man, it's just, I'm so excited about it.
They've got us doing other stuff. I mean, start with Race Virginia. For people who don't know what Race Virginia is, Race Virginia is a deal. And it goes back to two or three MassCast podcasts ago. Is that how you say it? MassCast podcast.
Either. Nah, either way is right. Fine. Yeah.
MassCast ago. We were talking about, and I got on my tirade about trying to do what we got to do for short tracks across the country. And I'm a firm believer in that. Well, Dennis, those guys at Richmond started that deal last year, first of last year, Race of Virginia. And basically what it is, it's a podcast, but it's a Twitter site and all that. Well, it's a group of them, and they formed this deal to try to help and expose all the short tracks in the state of Virginia, you know, because the short tracks of the state of Virginia, those fans go to the Richmond racetrack. I mean, we all know that. So they're doing, and they've done a lot of cool stuff with a lot of short tracks across our state, and, you know, helping them sponsor wise and helping them with events and helping just trying to get the word out and help these short tracks. So the Race in Virginia thing is, I'm hoping that each track or each state comes up with something that's comparable to Race in Virginia. In fact, I've been touting, I've talked to a few of the racetracks about that deal, try to get them on board to do that deal. And so anyhow, it's going to be exciting. Sharing, I guess we're going to do the MassCast first, and then we're going to share a podcast with Race of Virginia. Then it ends up Race of Virginia. Is that kind of the way it works?
I believe that's what we're going to do. Yeah, I think we're going to start it out, and then they're going to join us, and we'll do kind of a joint thing, and then maybe it goes into theirs, or maybe we just all end up hanging out on stage there together. I could see us just sitting there talking until Dennis or somebody says, "Hey, y'all got to shut up. You've been at this for too long. You know, it's time to wrap it up." You know, that'd be fine with me too. It's going to be 2:00 at the Midway Stage at Richmond.
At the Midway Stage.
Yes, that is what I have on schedule here.
2:00 Midway Stage. All right. Then where else they got us? They got us doing something else. What else they got us doing?
Let's see. I've got us at Richmond Nation reception at 3:30. Okay, so I guess we do have to shut up at some point before 3:30. That's going to be in the infield. Then the front porch at 4:30. And then after that, we're going to be sitting there eating and caviar. Drinking wine and dining. Yeah, the caviar omelets, if you will.
Where is the front porch?
I'm going to guess. Know, I'm going to guess it's on the other side of where the back porch is. That's my guess.
You reckon it's near Climax Corner?
Ooh, maybe it is. I hope so. I certainly hope so.
Is that a cool name, Climax Corner?
That's really where we ought to just be. They ought to just camp us out right there all day, right there on the inside of Climax Corner. That's where we ought to be all friggin' day.
I know. I can't wait. I saw the thing one time when it was under construction. They just had started, but I haven't seen the finished product.
Is that where the Skinner's bus was, Climax Corner?
Well, it could have been if I hadn't interrupted him, but no, yeah. That was at the other end of the racetrack.
Oh, okay.
Other end of the racetrack where that was. But I can't wait to see this new deal they've got.
I can't either.
I don't know. I keep going back to Climax Corner for some reason, but they're selling tickets to that deal, and people can go down there and watch a race from that up on top, I guess. And I don't know. It's just, I don't know. It's going to be a cool deal, but I can't wait to get down there.
Yeah, I was looking at pictures. Just before we started this, I was looking at Richmond was posting pictures of the new garage and stuff that's already done there in the infield. Man, it looks so cool. I'm giddy to see it with my own eyes. I mean, just obviously the podcast and everything, that's going to be fun. I'm excited just to see the place. It's going to be pretty friggin' cool.
I'll tell you something else is cool they did too. You know, we started, everybody talks about, who is it? Elliot Sadler promotes the bologna burger from South Boston. Well, dude, before Elliot was, when he was a little kid, I was eating bologna burgers at South Boston before he even knew what a race car was. So, you know, the bologna burger was a big deal. You take bologna, they'd fry it in big old slices of onion, mustard, and a hamburger bun. Well, a couple of years ago, I hadn't had one of those dudes in a long time. So we're at Richmond in the infield and had bologna burgers. I'm like, dude, I got to have one. I haven't had one in a while. Well, I ordered it. His thing came out and it's like two big pieces of, what is it? It's not French bread, but it's, it's like Texas toast, right?
Okay.
Thick piece of bread. These dudes had been toasted and saturated in butter, right? And the bologna was fried. I mean, it had to start out, I'm going to say somewhere between 3/8 and 1/2 inch thick before it started frying on it. And that thing was fried. It had this great big onion on it. I bit into that thing. I'm telling you, Ricky, I love bologna burgers, but never tasted a bologna burger like that dude until I had that. So anyhow, when that was all over, we've come home and I've tried to copy it at my house, doing it myself. I haven't been able to do it yet. So we're going to treat you to one down there at Richmond Saturday.
That's going to be, yeah, I'm looking forward to that. That's, you know, it's like the Martinsville hot, same deal with the Martinsville hot dog. You can buy Jesse Jones hot dog in the store. You can buy whatever bun it is they use. You can make it yourself. You can do everything the way you're supposed to, but it just don't taste the same. It's just the way you describe with that bologna burger. You have to actually have to go to Richmond this weekend and get yourself one. And that's what we're going to do when we're there. And I'm, man, I can't wait. 2:00, midway stage.
Not to change the subject, but we've tried to make those Elvis. What is that Elvis thing?
Is that the banana and peanut butter?
Yeah. I've tried that 6 times. It tastes like shit every time.
Yeah.
I don't do it anymore. Maybe we did it right and I just didn't like it. But yeah, it's going to be cool at Richmond.
Yeah. Come on down. And I know we've had some folks tweet us at Ricky Mast, at Rickmast 22 to say that they're going to be there. And they said, hey, can we, well, to you, they none of them care about getting a picture with me, but you know, they want to come by and say hi or get a picture or whatever. And I'm saying, yeah, come on out. So we'll be there. I mean, get there a little bit before too. To the midway stage, and I'll hold the camera for you and take the picture for you, and Dad there, and so we'll be hanging out there all day. I'm sure we'll get there before, we'll be there a little bit earlier in the day, and I'm planning on, I don't know, I'm thinking maybe I'm gonna bring me a, you know, Katie just got that GoPro that she took over to Ireland with her, my sister Katie. Maybe I'll steal that from her. And I'll strap that thing on me and just record the whole day. I definitely want to document our day at Richmond and then put that out on the social media sites next week. I think that'd be pretty cool. So I'm looking forward to it. So yeah, we'll do that MassCast Saturday. I think the plan is we'll record another one after the race. So you'll get a double, in addition to the first live, you'll get a double dip of MassCast next week. So it's going to be good, but you got to come out there, come out to Richmond and come out to the midway stage too. And come hang out with us. It's going to be a good time.
You know, the first autographs, I think, Ricky, that I ever got in my life, 1967, I was 10 years old. My dad took me to the race at Richmond, the old fairgrounds, his dirt track. Dude, I got an autograph from Richard Petty, and I got an autograph on a $1 bill from Wendell Scott.
That's awesome. Man, if you're the first two autographs you're ever going to get, that's kind of hard to top that.
It's kind of hard to top that, isn't it?
Yeah, you can't. You literally can't. If that's your first two and your NASCAR, and NASCAR is your path, you can't. Heck, put NASCAR aside, that's just your first two or just two Hall of Fame. Yeah, you can't. No, you can't put that aside. I think my first one was my first, you know, I'm obsessed with music. My first ever artist I really became obsessed with as a kid was old Ricky Van Shelton. I believe that maybe was my first autograph I remember getting. And you know who got it for me? All you folks out there. So obviously, you know, Ned Jarrett, his daughter, Patty, was she was what public relations with the Skull team, right? Early 90s.
She was my boss.
Yeah, essentially. Yeah. And she's married to Jimmy Maycar, who everybody knows in NASCAR also. She was at a, I believe a country music awards ceremony for something. And she knew how, and I was 6 or 7 years old, but I just loved Ricky Van Shelton. That was my first concert. You and mom took me to see him in Harrisonburg, Virginia, at JMU at the Convo Center. And she got me to Ricky from Ricky Van Shelton just on a little piece of paper at that that show. And I still have that. It's laminated. It's in a little safe I got here. So that's my first one. It means a lot to me. I don't think Ricky Van Shelton quite matches up to Richard Petty and Wendell Scott as your first two. That's pretty tough to beat there.
Yeah, I mean, that's as good as it gets. I mean, and I have fond memories of that track. Somebody flipped over. You know how things stick in your mind from a kid? A guy named Sam McQuaig.
Yeah.
That was a race car driver's name. I remember that car flipped over. I can picture it right now, sitting on its roof in turn one, going into turn one.
Where at now? Where was this at?
Richmond Fairgrounds.
Okay. See,
used to call it, before my time, it was called Strawberry Hill. I'm not sure. The historians can tell us why, but it was called Strawberry Hill, and it was changed to, I guess that was the area, Strawberry Hill, and then it was changed to Richmond Fairgrounds. So I guess when they had the fairgrounds there, and then the track was built.
Huh. You know, when you said Sam McQuaig, it's funny. The only other thing I'd ever heard about Sam McQuaig before, while I was familiar with that name, is there's footage of it, infamous footage of Sam McQuaig and Cale Yarborough getting together, I think at turn one. Is that Darlington? I can't remember if it was turn one or turn three. I'm going to say it's turn one at that time. You know what? Back in those days, that was when the front stretch was the back stretch. It was flipped. So either way, I'm right. Let's just go with that. It was either turn one or turn three. They got together, and Cale went out of the track and flipped over out of the bank. And you remember seeing that footage?
I remember, yeah. That picture comes up a lot. That was Sam McQuaig. I didn't realize that.
Yeah, that was Cale and got together with Sam McQuaig. So there you go. How about that?
That's what we need today. We need to see cars going out of the racetrack.
Yeah, there you go. That would definitely get some attention. I mean, everybody's trying to go viral online these days, and that would probably do it. Yeah, I would say so. Let's hope that doesn't happen to Richmond.
Give the fans what they ask for, I guess.
Yeah, you're right.
Here's a quote of the week, Ricky. Probably going to be tough for you to get this one.
Okay.
Winners never quit, and quitters never win. It's true in life. It's true on the track.
All right. Now, see the quote there. That could literally be. Usually, I can get a sense from when you give me these quotes. I'm trying to guess who said it. I can get a sense from the quote as to whether it's a driver, an owner, or pit crew member, or I guess or promoter.
You got no sense on this one, have you?
No, it's probably not a. Well, you know, I was going to say it's not a promoter, but as sure as I'm sitting here, I could see that's something I could see Humpy Wheeler or somebody like that saying, or Dennis in Richmond.
Yeah, you're never going to get it, but you're close.
I'm close?
Yeah, winners never quit and quitters never win. It's true in life. It's true on the racetrack.
So when you say I'm close, do you mean like I'm right line of thinking with promoters?
You were. Bill France Sr.
I'll be darned. Okay.
Bill France Sr. And you talking about a tough old codger. You know, and I looked at that. I saw that quote the other day, and it really got me to thinking about what we're doing now in our sport, what's going on, and you know, all the talk you watch on social media, especially after the Bristol race and everybody raising all the hell about nobody in the grandstands. And truly, it saddens me. It saddens me big time when I see that. And I don't like that. Now, with that being said, you know, it's 1,000% chance of rain on Sunday. So nobody's going to come. People that live there didn't even go to the racetrack. You know, people that were traveling didn't travel. So then they postponed the thing till Monday, which is always. In the past, you get whatever they do on Sunday, you'll see at best half that crowd on. In other words, if you got 100,000 people on Sunday, the best you'd ever hope for is to have 50,000 on Monday because everybody has to go back to work and the motels are expired and everybody goes back home. You know, the problem ahead with Sunday, with Monday is they were calling on rain. It was going to be a cold, miserable day again, right? So, you know, not a lot of fans there. So I kind of throw that one out. Although I do remember being at Bristol many times, it'd be snowing or raining or whatever, and the place is just packed. People wouldn't leave the enthusiasm. But when France talks about quitters and not quitting, you know, we have to collectively as a group, and I'm talking about NASCAR, I'm talking about the hierarchy of NASCAR, I'm talking about promoters, I'm talking about these friggin' drivers. I'm talking about everybody involved. You don't quit. You're trying to win. All right. Everybody's out there each week trying to win. That's what the teams try to do. But if you're going to win in front of 1,000 people, you know, and those 1,000 people are paying your bill, then you're not winning. You take a checkered flag, but you're not winning. Something is wrong. Somebody's not doing their part to have, instead of 1,000, have 100,000 people out there. And my point of view right now, you know, I think everybody has to take ownership for this thing, and everybody has to. I think if everybody involved in the sport would just take that quote and live with that quote every day, as far as interactions with our fans, because it comes down to the fans. If they're not sitting in the stands, okay, that's fine. You're not, the tracks don't make as much money. Everything right now is geared towards television. All right, we've got a good deal through what, 25 or whatever it is, or whenever that thing's up. You know, we've got to have enthusiasm out here across this country. And I just think you can't quit. As a driver, you can't quit. I keep harping on this. If you're a driver, you know, learn how to become a damn hero to your fan, right? As a driver, don't be a recluse. Don't be an asshole. Don't be a smart ass. Learn how to be heroes to these fans that work. You know, they work from paycheck to paycheck. They get up every day, take care of the kids. They go to work. They come home. They take care of the stuff. They volunteer the fire department or whatever they do. At the end of the week, they get the paycheck and they try to figure out how to make that money go and pay their bills. You know, they then like to turn on TV or go to an event or listen on the radio and connect with people that they really, really admire, and somebody that can be or become their hero, right? And for thousands and thousands of people over a long period of time, race car drivers filled that void, right? And the drivers, it came naturally to a lot of them. A lot of them understood that and worked to be a hero, right? And I think today's driver, they to me, quitting and not winning winning on the racetrack is a big deal. If you can't win, don't win or whatever. That's your ultimate goal. But you have to win over the fans. You can't quit. You can't quit on the fans. And I get frustrated with some of the guys. Now, I'm not trying to knock all the drivers. I'm not saying that. We have right now, in watching the races here lately, we've got the best talent of drivers, I think, in my mind, that I've ever witnessed. I think overall the talent level is through the roof. But, you know, it takes more than just talent and on-track performance to make this happen. It takes a persona. It takes a driver realizing what's going on outside of the race car and what he can do to better himself and what he can do to better the sport. And it's all those guys. That's just today's portion of how to fix NASCAR. We can go into this on MassCast for the next 5 years, 2 hours at a time. But today I'm concentrating on the drivers and about them winning and not quitting on the fans. It's just so important that these guys somehow or another get in their minds that they can't quit the fans. They've got to win over the fans. And to do that, there's ways you do that with your persona and the way your attitude is and the way you put yourself out there. And to be honest with you, visiting places. Just go visit, you know, go visit other little racetracks, sign autographs, whatever. That's one small thing that can be done to put this thing back on the right track.
There ain't a daggone thing I can add to that. That's perfect. That's perfect.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course it's perfect. Well I'm passionate about that, Ricky.
I can tell.
I'm passionate about it. I've witnessed, you know, when I came along, I mean, Richard Petty was still racing. Bobby had gotten hurt, but I raced against Bobby some, you know, raced against Cale and some of those guys, and they were all on the way out. But, you know, man, when I came along, I'll never forget the first time I got on the racetrack with those guys. It was like, good Lord have mercy. I'm out here on the racetrack with all these heroes of mine, right? I was in awe, to be honest with you. And then after a couple laps, I realized you got to stop this shit and think about your race car, you know. But in these guys, they were just larger than life personas, the way they were and the way they acted and the way they did things. And, you know, I witnessed all through the 90s, the explosion of the sport and how, you know, how people like Jeff and how people like Dale and how people responded. And I mean, how these drivers carried themselves, the way they acted, what they said, what they did outside of the car. And it just fed into the enthusiasm with the fans, because, you know, these fans, all of a sudden, man, these fans had heroes that they could look up to and just feel like they were part of them. And, We don't have that right now. You know, for whatever reasons, we don't have it. Not blaming the drivers for doing that. It might be a lack of not knowing about it, knowing how to do it or whatever, but we don't have it, but we have got to get that back somehow.
Yeah, I think so. I think you're absolutely right. And hopefully, I think the fact that we're talking about it here and that other people out there are talking about it, hopefully that gets us going back in the right direction. And most importantly of all this, what everybody can do to help is go to the races. Go to your local races. Go to the racetrack this weekend at Richmond. Come see us at Richmond this weekend, midway stage, 2 o'clock. All right? That's the main thing to do. Come on out to the race and see us. That will... I don't know if it'll fix all the problems you're just talking about, but it sure make us feel good. I know that.
Well, it would make us feel good. And one other thing I will say on social media, you see so many fans raising hell about everything wrong with NASCAR, and you just see it over and over and over. And I'm sitting here thinking, these people are so disgusted or mad with our sport, but they're on here every day voicing their concerns. That we've still got them. They're still fans of the sport, okay? So we need to harness them back in and make them positive again. So I know they're out there. But anyhow, maybe the MassCast going at Richmond, maybe that'll be the tide that turns this whole thing for this whole industry, Ricky. Just the MassCast at Richmond.
I think that's it, Dad. Nailed it. Well, and it all turns around this weekend at Richmond. We'll see you there.
There you go. All right, dude.
Thanks as always for listening, everybody. And hey, if you can, come on out to Richmond Raceway and see us this weekend. We're looking forward to it, and we certainly hope that you can join us. And as always, go ahead and hit that subscribe button, leave us a positive review and a 5-star rating. We'll see you next week on the MassCast.